campaign season in Jacksonville has a new issue to contend with, LGBT equality. That conversation is just ahead. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, First Coast Connect, always live on the radio, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, keep listening as we take a closer look at the mission of Jacksonville's new LGBT PAC. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a look ahead to the city's 7th annual Autism Symposium. Plus, we'll tell you how you can make some excellent business contacts and help set a world record all at the same time. It's all at one unique local event. All of that ahead. But first this morning, the issue of LGBT equality has emerged, one of the facets playing a role in Jacksonville's upcoming mayor's race. Recently, a new LGBT political action committee formed in the city and endorsed some of the candidates running for office. They say they're supporting those who've come out in favor of updating Jacksonville's human rights ordinance to cover LGBT citizens. Just this week, a new UNF poll was released showing 62% of Duval County voters support updating that ordinance. So this morning, we begin the hour with a closer look at this aspect of the mayor's race and the larger issues around the movement. PAC Vice Chairman and Jacksonville Attorney Jimmy Midyet joins us now in studio with his thoughts. Jimmy, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts about the push for LGBT equality in Jacksonville and how it's affecting our local election? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. You can also give us your comments on Facebook. So just a few weeks ago, you announced the formation of the Northeast Florida LGBT Leadership PAC. What's the purpose of the PAC?
The purpose of the PAC is to have, finally, a voice and a platform for the LGBT community to play a role in local politics, because in the aftermath of the human rights ordinance fight 3 years ago, we learned that we weren't well-positioned on the political front.
And so you're seeking to change that. That ordinance currently covers protection from discrimination in housing, employment, and public accommodations on the basis of race, sex, national origin, disability, age, I also believe, but does not provide protection on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, or expression. In 2012, the City Council voted down that change by one vote. You have since come out with some endorsements for mayor and city council candidates.
That's right. And we've also endorsed on the supervisor of elections race as well.
Okay. And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment at 549-2937 as we speak with LGBT Leadership PAC Vice Chair Jimmy Midyet. So your PAC, the purpose of a PAC is to push an issue, but also to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you on that?
We've raised a few thousand dollars since we started. Fundraising is not where I'd like to see it, but we're continuing to do so. And in my opinion, the most important thing that we could do was to actually form the PAC and get our list out there.
Let's talk about the list. You've endorsed Bill Bishop for mayor and also, as you mentioned, a candidate for supervisor of elections, Tracy Davis, and some city council candidates. On what basis did you pick those endorsements?
Okay, that's a great question. What we did was we actually went out and had one-on-one conversations with each of the candidates running, and we did that personally, and other members of the LGBT community involved in that effort, and so we got that information back. We sort of went through it. And we looked at it, we looked at the group on that basis. We didn't look at how much money someone has raised or anything like that. We just wanted to see who is with us on the human rights ordinance.
And what would you say to those in the LGBT community who have said privately, Jimmy, you know what, this isn't helping our cause. It's better to negotiate behind the scenes, quietly, not harm strong candidates who might be competing for votes in parts of town that are against this issue of LGBT equality?
Well, I think personally I learned in 2012 that working behind the scenes doesn't always produce a good outcome. So to me, for my own personal integrity and that of the LGBT community, I think it's much more important to be out front in public talking about this very important issue. Not in the shadows or in a back room, you know, trying to make a deal. It's time to be out front.
And in just a moment, we'll go to your calls on this issue. You can weigh in. As a new UNF poll shows, 62% of Duval County voters say they're in favor of updating the city's human rights ordinance to cover the LGBT community. What are your thoughts? We'll go to the phones in just a moment at 549-2937. Let me ask you this as well, because you're a prominent advocate on this issue. The new poll out shows the majority of people are in support of this change. Florida now has legalized same-sex marriage along with the majority of the other states. On the other hand, there are still those who have strongly held convictions the other way. Just yesterday, a new Christian Voters Guide was released advising voters to vote for candidates who have pledged that they will vote the opposite way on this issue. And these are deeply held beliefs for some people in this community. What's your response to those listening that disagree?
Well, I absolutely respect their deeply held religious beliefs. I mean... Everyone has some core of personal conviction that motivates them. And I don't question the motives of people like that and people who really do come into the public square with those strong views. My only problem with that is that whenever those strong views conflict with what are essentially constitutional rights to be free of government based on those religious views, that's where I begin to have a conflict and where we part ways. Now, I'll say what was interesting about the UNF poll, digging deeper in, that it said that 15% of Republicans are actually in support of these human rights ordinance measures here in Jacksonville. We have a majority of African Americans who are actually in support of these protections in Jacksonville. The UNF survey or poll that was released is really a treasure trove of information for those of us who are advocates of making these changes to our human rights ordinance.
When it comes to that issue, two of the candidates in the race, incumbent Mayor Brown and Lenny Curry, have really been noncommittal about the issue. Omega Allen, the no party affiliated candidate, has expressed limited support for updating this ordinance. Bill Bishop, the other Republican in the race, has said he's fully in support of it. Based on that, that's why you, a Democrat, are endorsing Republican Bill Bishop?
Well, it's important to point out that it's the PAC that's endorsing Bill Bishop.
Right.
But yes, as a Democrat, I've had the opportunity to speak with Bill at length. I've watched him in a leadership role as council president when the HRO vote actually came up in 2012. I think that Bill has a tremendous amount of integrity, and he has really evolved and become a leader on this issue. And so for the LGBT community, and we've identified about 30,000 voters in Jacksonville for whom this issue is important, we're all looking for someone who's willing to take a step of leadership on this issue, which we have not yet had from the mayor.
Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, I say it because mostly because it's true. You know, whenever we came together to help elect Alvin Brown 4 years ago, it was our understanding that the human rights ordinance was something that was important for him, mostly because of comments that he made on the campaign trail. And I think that the fact that he was running at that point against Audrey Moran, who made that an important part of her campaign, sort of brought the mayor into line with our thinking. And then, you know, we were quite surprised to learn after the election that that priority was not, in fact, a priority for his administration. So we're out looking for a candidate who is.
What would you say to those listening who might argue, yes, I understand why you're passionate about this issue, but is it wise to be a single issue voter?
I think that's a fair argument. But what happened in 2012, what we saw, it's not a single issue to me, because what we saw in 2012 was real hate, was a real a visceral sort of bigoted reaction from part of the community to LGBT people. And so frankly, there weren't advocates in the city council up on the dais who were calling that behavior out. And so to me, It says it's not even just about the ordinance. It's not even just about how we think or feel about LGBT people in Jacksonville. It's really about how we treat our neighbors and how we treat each other. And so that's why I think this is a checkbox that we need to check and move on in Jacksonville to our bigger problems.
And if you're just tuning in right now, we want to know, what are your thoughts about the city's new LGBT PAC, the issue of the human rights ordinance, and how this is playing into the city's mayor's race and other races? 549-2937. Let's go to Ron. He's just south of Jacksonville. Hello, Ron.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I want to make a comment. I want to say that I'm a God-fearing Christian man, and I love this guy here and anybody else who is thinking they're homosexual. But personally, me and my 50,000 pastors that want to talk to President Obama about this thing believe that this is a choice, and that we don't believe that anybody who desires this lifestyle should have any impact on someone else's children. I want to know this ordinance that he wants. Since there seems to be so much of a moving of the goalposts all the time with LGBT people, I want to know if this ordinance is going to have anything to do with guys confused about their sexuality being able to go into a female restroom. You know, and I think there's a safety issue there. I don't think anybody should have the right to teach someone's children this kind of lifestyle without that parent's consent. So there's a lot of questions that people who love God and who love you, sir. Matter of fact, this is not a, you keep on saying bigot, but we love everybody. We just know that this lifestyle, I mean, because we believe that Sodom and Gomorrah really happened.
Okay, so, Ron. Thanks for the call. Thanks, Ron. That's Ron calling from just south of Jacksonville. Okay, a lot in that call. Ron, echoing the comments of mayoral candidate Omega Allen on this program recently, where she said she believes homosexuality is a choice and also referred to it as a lifestyle. That is the kind of rhetoric many Christians say. And he also had concerns about the gender identity and expression part of the ordinance. Mm-hmm. So what are your responses to all of that?
That's a lot to unpack. I mean, I appreciate, Ron, I appreciate you, and thank you for loving me. I similarly love you and all those who think that I've made some choice and that I have a deviant lifestyle. But you can hear in that language that it's not the language of love whenever you demean people in that way. I never made a choice. I suspect that you never made a choice, assuming that you're heterosexual, to be heterosexual. But to pull it back to the point of the ordinance, this has nothing to do about promoting homosexuality or ideas about gender identity to school children or frankly to anyone else. This is simply about fairness in employment, housing, and public accommodations. And the question that you made about restroom use is one that we have seen brought up around the country.
There's a bill in Tallahassee right now that would ban someone a transgender person from going to the opposite bathroom, isn't there?
There is. It was filed by Representative Artiles from Miami, essentially in reaction to Miami recently updating their human rights ordinance to include gender identity. They had a sexual orientation only ordinance since 91 or so, and so anyway, it's shameful and hurtful and demeaning and dehumanizing to tell people they're not allowed to go to the restroom in public, and that is really where I come down on it.
Autumn in Lakeshore, go ahead, Autumn. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a comment based on the idea that only Christians are full of hate or whatever. I consider myself a Christian. And I know this is not what this man, I'm sorry, I forgot the speaker's name, is preaching or saying, but a lot of people who are Christian do believe in equal rights for everyone. I certainly do. God taught us, or at least my God taught me, that love everyone as myself. And I don't think there's anything wrong with loving everyone.
Thanks, Autumn.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Thanks for the call.
Autumn, I'm Jimmy, and I appreciate you saying that. I'm a Christian, too, and the God that I worship is the same way. He's a loving God. It's I'm a Sermon on the Mount, Book of Matthew kind of Christian, so I'm right there with you.
549-2937 as we go to Josh in Lakeport. Hello, Josh.
Hello. I have more of a question than a comment. Since there's not an opposing view there, to whatever extent you can, with one or both of you, explain to us what the gaps are in the federal law and why this is needed.
Why it's necessary.
I don't really understand it totally. I would come down as opposed to it in the lack information, because I think generally our poor country seems to be making decisions based on our, our genitals seem to make our decisions for it. By his own admission, he once, supported Brown and is now supporting Bishop. So we seem to careen left and right on a one issue. As you mentioned, Melissa, on a one issue thing.
Okay.
Please tell us, why do we need this?
Yeah, thank you, Josh, for the question. Why is this necessary? Jimmy Midyat.
Okay, Josh, this is a great question, and it's something that we heard a lot 3 years ago and since. There is absolutely no federal law on point that outlaws discrimination in employment on sexual orientation or gender identity.
What about housing accommodations?
Nothing on public accommodations. Some HUD, since the election of President Obama, some HUD regulations have been read and construed to outlaw discrimination on housing in
federally controlled housing?
Exactly, in federally controlled housing, affordable housing and things of that nature, not in private real estate transactions or in situations where there's no HUD voucher or something like that. I don't want to get too far into the weeds on the law, but the point remains that there's simply no federal law. There has been an attempt since 96 to pass what's called the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, but it has gone nowhere even when President Clinton was in office. And with the current makeup of the Congress, it's unlikely to go anywhere at this point. There's also a bill in Tallahassee called the Florida Competitive Workforce Act to try and extend those same protections on the state basis, but it has, frankly, has very little chance to go anywhere.
So in the absence of a federal law, it's my understanding that many municipalities have passed a local ordinance, Jacksonville being one of the last major city holdouts. Is that right?
That's right. So more than 50% of Floridians are covered by a human rights ordinance that has been passed at the county or state, at the county or city level. But of course, Jacksonville being both the most populous and the largest city, county in the state, we lag behind.
549-2937. What are your thoughts? Let's go to Barbara in Atlantic Beach now. Hey, Barbara, how are you today?
Good morning. And I'm delighted you're covering this because it answered some questions that I'd had about the upcoming race. I'd like to know, first off, I'd like to say I'm a Christian, and when you were saying 30,000, you had identified 30,000 voters in the Jacksonville area who supported that. In my head, I thought, oh, 30,001, counting me in. But I'd like to know, where is the list of the candidates that y'all have endorsed, that the PAC has endorsed?
Well, Barbara, thank you for your call. I didn't mean to cut Melissa off.
No, you're fine.
But you can find our list at LGBTPAC.com. LGBTPAC.com. And if you're on Facebook, you can just search for us. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're everywhere.
And right now we're speaking with the PAC's Jimmy Midyat about the push for LGBT equality on the First Coast. We'll go back to your calls in just a moment. Feedback coming in on social media. Adam writes on our Facebook page, from the results of the UNF poll, it looks like roughly 2/3 of the city supports equality in the workplace, housing, and public accommodations. It only makes sense that our city council should reflect that support of fairness and civil rights. Mike tweets the show, Jacksonville can't move forward till all residents are treated fairly under the law. It was instructive to look at the UNF poll. There were a range of issues covered in that poll, by the way. People revealed where they stood on crime, education, the river, the pension situation. But out of all the issues polled, this issue, Jimmy, actually had the strongest support, bipartisan support, which I think surprised some people.
Well, it didn't surprise me because...
It did not surprise you.
It did not, because we have been working very thoughtfully since 2012 to educate people in Jacksonville. And by we, I now mean an organization that I was a part of, the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality. So the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality has been working with all of its coalition members, including Jasmine and Equality Florida and others, to educate the community about the need for this issue and to demystify some of the scary, quote unquote, scarier parts of this. And so I think that becomes reflected in the survey. Most people in Jacksonville, and we've heard several of them, we shouldn't cast a wide net and say that all Christians are in opposition, because clearly I think a majority of Christians are in support of treating people fairly.
549-2937. Brian in historic Springfield is with us. Hello, Brian.
Yeah, hi there. Good morning. I just wanted to call to thank your speaker for bringing this issue up today on your program. I think it's a really important issue that a lot of Jacksonvillians don't quite think about. So having representation in this arena really means a lot. So thank you very much, Jimmy.
Thank you, Brian.
I did have a quick comment. You know, another person who called in said that they didn't quite understand why this was an important issue, and just because he would most likely vote no because he didn't have all the information. And one of the things that I wanted to share was that I was recently laid off from a position that I held for 6 years with the University of Florida. And I've explored this from multiple angles as to why I would have been released from my job with a great job performance review, a promotion that I had from within. And then as soon as I started working under one individual, I was laid off without one word, one of anything, no iota of any type of information. And so after looking at all my job performances and all the things that I contributed to the practice, it only brought me back to one decision, is that it had to be something personable about myself. And so the only thing that I could think that was personally different about me than the rest of my coworkers is the fact that I'm a gay male. And that was known in the practice, but by the powers that be, the people that are higher above, who aren't quite in line with that, as maybe some of the younger coworkers was, I feel like this really could have been a legitimate reason based on my sexuality. But the reason why things like this are important is because it brings the opportunity of fairness and legal recourse for people that are in my situation. If this is indeed my situation, I think that's something that people don't quite understand. You know, you walk into work one day and then your job is just gone and no one will tell you anything. And so you really start to pick yourself apart and wonder, well, is it something about me that made this happen? And so that's one of the reasons why legislature like this is very valuable. And it's such an asset for people like Jimmy to be out here promoting it and to help other people understand the necessity behind it.
That's Brian in Springfield. Thanks for the call, Brian.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. I appreciate those words. And it is the case that right now in Jacksonville, it would be perfectly legal for that situation to occur. You can absolutely right now today be fired from your job if you happen to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender.
On the other hand, it's been interesting to watch how the corporate community in this city has acted on its own. Many large companies in Jacksonville offer these sorts of workplace protections, saying that it aids recruitment.
That's the case. I mean, we've heard over and over again that in order to attract the best talent and to have a good pool of applicants and really get the right people in Jacksonville, that these things are necessary. And so the companies are doing them. But the problem is, and that this is something that Mr. Steve Halverson has communicated, is that
The CEO of Haskell Company
has communicated is that while he tries to attract that talent, and maybe he can based on the non-discrimination of his company, the moment that that person or their spouse walks off of the corporate campus, they can be denied housing. They could be thrown out of a restaurant. The spouse may not be, if there's a spouse, they may not be as lucky to have a job with an enlightened CEO like Mr. Halverson. They may work for the city where we still don't have municipal protections against being discriminated. And so, as much as the corporate culture and the corporations can do, it's the fact that it's up to our government. It's up to the city to extend this protection and to make Jacksonville a welcoming place to everyone.
James is on the road and on the phone. Hi, James. Thanks for calling in. Good morning.
Good morning. The reason I'm calling, three things. First, I like a little humor to lighten things up. Then I'll say something as a citizen, thirdly, as a minister. The first one's humor. I often believe it's quite legitimate for gays and lesbians to marry. Why shouldn't they have the right to suffer like the rest of us? They'll find out it ain't always. Second, as an American citizen, I just hate to think I live in a country that writes on paper freedom and justice for all, and all don't get justice. That's the second reason I want America to live up into its own professions. And thirdly, as a minister, I think the bottom line is when I'm with any relationship at any level, am I there to really help build that person up, or am I there just to use them? I don't care if you're gay or straight or what have you. If I'm in a relationship with a hetero or homosexual, then that other person is simply an object for me to enjoy for my own pleasure I'm really not doing using them. I don't know what I am or what I'm not. Naturally, we all do use each other, but
all
it's
right,
a matter
James.
Of degree.
Thanks for the call, James. Henry on the north side. Go ahead, Henry.
Yes, I wanted to ask your guest. Thank you very much for having me on the phone, Melissa. And I wanted to ask your guest a question, A-B question. First of all, do you think this has anything to do, the discrimination issues has anything to do with, first of all, the right to work state that Florida is and the trend that we're seeing in other states for the right to work, which gives, of course, the employer the right to fire anybody under any kind of circumstances, and the fact that the unions are in demise. So those are my two questions.
Thanks for the call, Henry.
Henry, those are very interesting questions. I don't think that that it really impacts the fact that Florida is a right to work state. I mean, even though we are a right to work state, shamefully, I might add, it's the case that the employer still can't fire someone on the basis of a protected class. So, you know, as an employer, you couldn't fire someone who's African American based on their race, or you couldn't, the station here couldn't fire Melissa because she's a woman, even though we are an at-will state. So that's not necessarily impacted, but you do mention the labor movement, and what we found is that the labor movement has been instrumental in helping us to pass these protections.
One final question for you. You have come out in support of Bill Bishop for mayor. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that Mr. Bishop does not make it through the March 24th unitary election and does not make it into the runoff election set for May. Will you support one of the other two candidates at that point?
I think at that point the PAC board will have to have some discussion to determine who of those two candidates will take us best into the future, if any. And we would reserve the right to make no. We certainly reserve the right to make no endorsement. Although we're very hopeful that Mr. Bishop is elected outright on the 24th, and or at least goes on to May.
Jimmy Midyat, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead later, how you can make business contacts around town and help set a world record all at the same time. But up next, cutting-edge autism research and treatment will be part of this city's 7th annual Autism Symposium. Anyone with a child on the spectrum needs to listen. That's next.
Who will be Jacksonville's next mayor? Where do the candidates stand on the issues affecting the First Coast, such as pensions, taxes, public health and safety, downtown development, and the city's human rights ordinance? WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present Jacksonville 2015. The first debate with mayoral candidates Alvin Brown, Bill Bishop, and Lenny Curry. Jacksonville 2015, Thursday night at 7 on WJCT Public Television.
I called him the Candyman.
Staffers knew what a VA doctor was up to, but no one was listening.
I said that your own chief of psychiatry hands out narcotics like they're candy. And the director, sat back in his chair and, laughed.
Next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Sunday at 1 on WJCT 89.9.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
I was 6 years old riding around in my parents' car, and I was like, what is this stuff? And I just kept listening.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again tomorrow to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
The Florida Legislature is in session, and Capitol Report is your nightly connection to what's happening in Tallahassee as lawmakers debate and decide issues that affect all Floridians, such as expanding health care and gambling, protecting the state's water resources, private versus public schools, and prison reform. Hear Capitol Report each weeknight during the legislative session on this Florida Public Radio station.
Weeknights at 6:30 on WJCT 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, on Wednesday, Wolfson Children's Hospital will present its seventh annual Autism Symposium on the UNF campus. Nationally renowned researchers and clinicians on the disorder will be speaking at this event. We have a preview for you right now. Here to tell us all about the latest advances in autism spectrum disorders awareness and treatment, we welcome two of the speakers from tomorrow's symposium, Dr. Brian King, director of Seattle Children's Autism Center, Dr. Raphael Bernier, clinical director at the center. Doctors, good morning to you both.
Good morning. Morning.
And also with us, Jackie Bargas, the Autism Symposium's program manager. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So we'll speak with the docs in a moment. But first, Jackie, this event is really important when it comes to autism awareness and research and treatment on the First Coast. Can you tell us a little bit about what will be happening?
Yes. Well, the symposium tonight kicks off with a CME dinner for physicians, and Dr. King is our keynote speaker, so he'll be delivering a lecture tonight at the River Club. And then tomorrow we open the symposium at 9 o'clock, and that is on the campus of UNF at the University Center. And it's going to it's open to the medical doctor down to the caregiver. So we invite everyone to
attend.
Everyone
should come who is interested in this. So Dr. King, can you give us a short window into your keynote?
I think that the most important thing I'm going to try to do is not ruin a good dinner.
Always important.
So the focus for tonight will be to talk about the evolution of diagnostic criteria for autism over time.
And you've been extremely influential in changes to that, haven't you?
I have had a nice opportunity to be on the front lines of evaluating and changing the criteria.
And for people who haven't followed this closely, how have the criteria changed?
Well, over the years, as we've learned more and more about what constitutes autism, from some of the genetic studies, for example, and the clinical studies as well, we've learned that it really is a broader spectrum than what was initially envisioned. And the criteria now reflect that, both in terms of the actual name of the disorder as autism spectrum disorder, and also in terms of the way we make the diagnosis.
And Dr. Bernier, let's bring you into the discussion. You have expertise in evaluating and counseling children and parents and working with families. Can you share with us a little bit about your thoughts on some of these changes and what parents might need to know and get up to speed about?
Yeah, that's a great question, a great topic, certainly thinking about the family experience of it. What I think is great about some of the changes in terms of the way we diagnose autism is we're really encompassing the current research much more, as Dr. King had mentioned, that we've sort of moved to a term that really encompasses really the broad array of what we're seeing. You know, there's an expression, you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism.
Right, exactly.
And the research is bearing that out in many ways in terms of some of the stuff we've been doing in identifying the genetic contributors to autism.
Let's talk about that because, of course, the cause of autism has been very controversial over the years. Where do you both fall on that when it comes to trying to identify genetic and or environmental contributors to this disorder?
Mm-hmm. Well, clearly both. There's an interplay of nature and nurture with autism, absolutely. And part of the frustration, I think, over time has been that we don't have good candidates for the cause. It's reasonable when one rises to the top to take a close look at it. But we're still at a place where we haven't yet identified particular environmental contributions. We're learning more and more about the genetics, though, and that will guide us ultimately to where to look for environmental causes.
And what are some of the genetic markers or mutations that can lead to a diagnosis?
Well, we've made significant advances just in the past 5 years. We know that specific single gene disruptions account for about a third of all boys diagnosed with autism, and about 45% of girls diagnosed with autism can be linked back to very specific genetic events. We call them de novo events. That is, these are not inherited or passed on genetic changes, but that arise anew very early on in development. But there's a lot of them. Our estimate is that there's 822 distinct different genes that are contributing to autism, as well as a number of other type of genetic events, structural changes. But what makes it complicated is they're No one of these accounts for more than 1% of all cases of autism. And that's why it gets very confusing, because we have a number of different genetic contributors that are interacting with their environment. And by environment, we're talking about the genetic environment, that is the other genes in that makeup, as well as the early uterine environment potentially is one of the things that is looked at.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, you have some history in terms of what your parents did for a living that has motivated you to work with children with autism. You've also developed a program to train teenagers to mentor their peers with autism. Is that right?
Well, yes. So it's funny. Yeah. Both my parents are in the health profession. I remember being around the dinner table as a kiddo, and my dad said, you know, you're not doing important work unless you're helping other people, son. I said, gosh, that's a lot of pressure. At any rate. But as a doctoral student at the University of Washington years ago, I was frustrated when I would work with a family, work with a young child with autism, and wanted to get that linked up with service in the community. And there, you know, there is expertise out there, but not as much as there should be, given the number of children that that need to be served. So,
well, and Dr. King, of course, says the diagnostic criteria has expanded. Many more children now are classified as being somewhere on this spectrum. In the meantime, you've been working on clinical trials in Seattle. Can you share with us the details of those?
Sure. But let me say that I think although the diagnostic criteria have changed, I'm not sure that the reason that we see more and more people with autism
is because of the criteria.
No, with virtually the same criteria untouched over 17 years before this last iteration, we saw percentage increases in the nearly 1,000%. So the expansion in the numbers is probably not just a function of us accommodating more people with the criteria. In terms of
something's driving the increase in autism.
Absolutely.
We just don't know what it is.
We don't. And in terms of the clinical trials, one of the things that has positioned us in a wonderful way compared to years ago are the findings from genetic studies that have identified specific pathways that appear to be involved, which then suggest new molecules that we might look at to, in essence, repair or modify some of those pathways. One of the other points to make, just building on what Rafe was saying earlier about the genes that contribute risk, is that that's exactly what they do. There isn't an autism gene. There is no gene that is a straight line from its abnormal expression to autism as an outcome, which also complicates these things.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about the DAN protocol where parents try a gluten and casein-free diet, since there's some evidence to show that autism can really affect the child's gut. And when they change the child's diet, they often see an improvement in behavior.
So it's perfectly reasonable for people, and certainly many parents do explore dietary changes in order to address issues with abnormal bowel function. So and clearly, either constipation or diarrhea are common. Autism doesn't protect you from those sorts of symptoms. There is a difference, though, between addressing some of those issues and addressing autism as it at its core with those dietary interventions. And there isn't evidence that would suggest that because you have autism, you should be on a diet. It's perfectly reasonable, however, if you do have some problem with your gut, that you might want to explore dietary changes.
And Jackie, for people listening, not too late for people to register to attend?
Absolutely not. They can go to wolfsonchildrens.org/autism.
And it's tomorrow all day.
Tomorrow all day.
At the UNF Center.
At the UNF Center.
Anything else coming up besides these two brilliant men who will be speaking that we could mention to folks?
Well, it's a collaborative effort between Wolfson Children's Hospital, Nemours Children's Clinic, and UF Health, and we bring all of those specialists together who are on our steering committee and committee chairs. So we're a shout out to all those great people who help us put that on.
Well, thank you all three of you so much for being with us. Such an important topic. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa.
We were joined by Dr. Brian King and Dr. Raphael Bernier, both speaking at tomorrow's 7th annual Autism Symposium. Jackie Bargas of Wolfson Children's Hospital. The event sponsor also with us today. Again, that event is tomorrow at the UNF University Center. And we're back in a moment.
Congratulations to writer James English, winner of the first quarter of The Square. Now it's your chance to show off your art, whether it's music, visual art, sculpture, poetry, and more. Go to wjct.org/The Square, check out the amazing local talent, and submit your work now.
When a mama and daddy moved into the house across the street.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through March 16th at 9 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Listen to After Hours to relax with music that spans the world in all styles from classical to doo-wop. Weeknights at 7, only on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it's your chance to try to set a world record and prove that Jacksonville is the most business-friendly city in America. Yes, the world's largest business speed networking event is set for April 1st at the Morocco Shrine Center. Here with a preview, we welcome event co-founders Brian Barkia and Dolly Penland. Guys, good morning to you both.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us on.
So this is going to be like speed dating, but for business, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Melissa. How it works on April 1st from 2:30 to 5:30 at the Morocco Shrine, we have business leaders from all across the community are going to come, and you're guaranteed to meet at least 20 new business contacts.
Very nice.
Right? And at the same time, you will leave that you will leave there being a world record holder.
And so, yeah, Dolly, tell us about this. You're trying to get into the Guinness books, correct?
Yes. So the record was first set by an Australian group a few years ago, and they had 476 people. Guinness, because we're in contact, and Guinness will actually be on site for the event, the Guinness World Record staff to certify the event that day, notified us right before the holidays that a London group had beaten it, and the record now is 487.
Okay.
So we can kill the record with 500 participants. Yay!
So your goal is to get 500 people to the Morocco Shrine on April Fool's Day. Oh, no fooling. This is for real, right?
It's, yes. A lot of work and a very expensive. I was joking with Brian. I was like, the next time somebody asks me to set a world record, I want to just grow my nails really long or something because it'll be a lot easier.
I can imagine. So who are you hoping comes out? Just anyone and everyone who's looking to network and make some contacts?
Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, if you do business in this town, it's not who knows you, or it's not who you know, but who knows you, and this is a great opportunity to start to do that.
That's right. So anybody genuinely connected in the business community, business owners, executives, people who are in sales, anybody who wants to meet, share their startup idea, we've got a lot of support from all different business groups in the community. anybody who wants to promote their business or just make connections, genuine business connections with like-minded individuals.
Yeah, and you're also trying to build on Jacksonville's reputation as a city that's open for business, a business-friendly place. How much does that factor into what you're doing?
Well, it for sure is the overriding theme of what we're doing. We want to make Jacksonville the most business-friendly city in the world, and we want to put an event like this somewhat on our resume, if that's how it works. You know, we're in partnership with the Jax USA and the Jacksonville Chamber on this group, among some of our other sponsors, including the Florida Times Union, Logo Nation, BNI.
Destination Planning.
That's right.
Axia Public Relations. We have a bunch of sponsors that are helping out, including our companies. We're not even sharing our companies, Predictive Results and Advantage Magazine. But the idea is for... Jacksonville is consistently rated as a business-friendly environment. We have a very pro-business community. We have excellent cost of living. We have an educated workforce. We have all of these things. But you always hear people say they're open for business. You never hear, like, Madison, Wisconsin going, woo, we're full. We don't want any more business here. Houston's not saying, hey, we need to put up a border fence to keep the new business out, right? So everybody is open for business.
Sure.
This is a way to truly prove to the world, because it is a world record, that Jacksonville is open for business and that we are the most business-friendly community, period.
And you want to make this fun, too.
Oh, yeah. Business isn't boring. There's not a person who will be at that event that hasn't been supercharged by making a great deal or having a super product or whatever it is.
Now, let's explain the rules of this. When you go to speed dating, you know, you're not going to make this like that scene in The 40-Year-Old Virgin where it's a disaster when they go to speed dating. You want this to be productive. So what are some tips and strategies for people that come out to this? How much time will they have with each contact and all of that?
So the official rules are 3 minutes each. And what we've been doing is sending out a series of emails to those who are already registered and signed up. Basically, if Brian and I were facing each other, I'd get my 30-second elevator speech. He'd get his 30-second elevator speech. And then we have the rest of the time in that 3-minute window to ask questions. A buzzer will sound, and then everybody will move to their right. So I'll move to my right, and then I'll have a new person. And this will go on for an hour, just over an hour, hour and 15 minutes.
How'd you guys come up with the idea?
Oh, this is Brian's fault.
His fault.
Well, my day job, Melissa, is I'm the publisher of Advantage Business Magazine, and our goal is to really unite the business community and help people run a more efficient, more profitable business. This is one of the events, and this is by far going to be the largest event we've ever done, but wanted to do something on a grander scale that had a bigger theme than just the Advantage Business Magazine, something that was light on branding and one organization didn't necessarily represent, something that everybody could pull together. So it started a long time ago. I have a list in my closet of things I want to accomplish before I leave this earth. And
his bucket list.
That's right. And break a world record was on there for no good reason, just because. And I wasn't willing to let my fingernails grow out or wear 200 t-shirts, so I figured, hey, why not do something that's business-related? So, you know, started asking around a little bit, and it seemed like an idea that everybody could get around. And by far, the number one question or the number one comment that people have when we talk to them about it is, hey, is this an April Fool's joke? The answer is no, it's not.
This is real.
This is real.
Yes.
And the second question is, how many people? We tell them 487 set in London in October of this past year, and everybody says, hey, that's doable. We could do that. We could really own this. So we're looking forward to it. But here's the key. We've got to get people to jacksworldrecord.com, because when you're on that site, you'll be able to take the pledge that says, yes, I'll be there, and it sounds like a neat event. That's the mechanism we use to wrap our arms around the entire attendee list. And you were asking earlier, what can people do to prepare for the world record? This is when you go and register, we will continue to stay in touch with you with different emails and tips on how to make this a positive experience for you.
And one thing they can expect is if they register, that's part of our reporting requirements for Guinness, because this is going to be a certified actual record. They will get fast passed into the event, so they don't have to register at that time. Basically, they will be able to, you know, have their ticket, walk right up, go right in. They get a numbered wristband, which is how we will tally the totals who actually attend that day. and they'll be able to go directly in and pick their seats. We can actually accommodate as many as 2,000 people. If we get 2,000, we'll not only have broken the record, we just smashed it into little tiny pieces.
But let's shoot for 500. Go to jacksworldrecord.com and sign up and mark your calendars for April 1st and the city's first ever business speed networking event. Help get into the Guinness Book of World Records. And I assume there will be alcohol at this gathering for people. maybe at cocktail hour, just a little added incentive.
After party.
After party. There you go. And business no first, cost. Then the party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is it. We mean business. And there's also no cost to attend. So we are fully encouraging people who want to walk away with 20 genuine business connections to sign up, take the pledge.
Again, that's jacksworldrecord.com. It's not an April Fool's joke. April 1st at the Morocco Shrine. Co-founders Brian Barkia and Dolly Penland, you guys are on the move. Thanks for sharing all this with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got feedback we always want to hear, just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And catch our daily podcast. Never miss a show. Just subscribe to FCC on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has turned over 55,000 pages of emails from her controversial private account. A look at the investigation into her compliance or not with federal rules and what it might mean for her likely run as a presidential candidate. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.